Philippe Pinel, one of the founding fathers of psychology as we know today, rose to prominence in the 1790s when he was selected to be one of the attendant physicians at King Louis XVI's beheading. Soon after, he received an appointment to become the chief physician at the Paris Asylum for Men. You must understand that during this time, mental illness was not treated as it is today. The insane, as they were called for centuries, were believed to be possessed by the devil, or simply, unruly by choice. They were imprisoned and shackled to a wall day and night for years on end in solitary confinement. They were treated with bloodletting. They were conditioned to fear their doctors, and repeatedly plunged in a bathtub until they were near death in the hope that the insane would just change their ways. That is, if they survived. Insanity in those days could be diagnosed to anyone who didn't appeal to social norms. Excessive writing, insomnia, extended illness, and women who committed adultery were among a list of 46 symptoms where someone could be declared insane. When Philippe arrived at the asylum, he was determined to take a different approach. There were no more shackles, the patients were put on a regular routine, and Philippe met one-on-one with each patient every day. He received incredible scrutiny, yet he believed that these patients shouldn't be clumped into a single diagnosis, and through his daily tasks with new patients, he learned that the state of one's mental illness wasn't derived by a single event, but a culmination of events in addition to a person's hereditary traits. Philippe shocked the medical world with his studies and led the way with his belief that both nature and nurture play a part in mental illness. That a person is predisposed at birth when an imbalance to process emotions coupled with physical and social stressors in the development of a person's life. In 1801, Dr. Philippe Pinel published his findings in his Treatise on Insanity, in which he listed mental illness in 5 classifications: melancholia, dementia, idiotism, mania with delirium, and mania without delirium. These classifications, among others, still stand today. However, most go by different names, such as depression, intellectual disability, schizophrenia, and antisocial personality disorder, commonly known as a sociopath. A sociopath is described as someone who is manipulative, incapable of empathy, remorse, or love, poor impulse controls, and has a grandiose sense of self. Nearly 134 years after Dr. Pinel published his findings, a boy was born in Jersey City, New Jersey, who would grow to epitomize the diagnosis of a sociopath, as he would create a double life between being a family man and becoming one of the country's most prolific killers, in which he claims to have murdered well over 200 people. A man known to his family as Richard Kuklinski, but to the criminal underworld, he was the Iceman.
I'm Dave Jari, and I am the Serial Holic.
Richard Kuklinski was the second born to Stanley and Anna Kuklinski, Polish and Irish immigrants who were never destined to be declared parents of the year. He was raised in a low-income housing project, with Stanley working as a brakeman for the railroad and Anna working in the meat packaging plant. Stanley was an alcoholic who had severely beat Anna, Richard, and his older brother Florian. Anna was also quick with physical discipline, believing that physical punishment went hand in hand with a strong religious upbringing.
I didn't like my father, because he would beat me just because he felt like it. To get my attention, I guess. He'd just come in and give you a whooping for no reason whatsoever. And my mother was cancer. She would destroy everybody. She thought I took long to do something. She didn't hesitate to give me a swat here and there. And she didn't just use her hands. She would hit me with a broomstick or something like that. It hurt. As a matter of fact, she broke the broom on me more than once.
So in essence, Richard and Florian had no reprieve from constant abuse. His father would soon abandon the family, and Richard, acting out in anger, would capture the neighborhood animals and torture them by skinning them while they were still alive, throwing them in incinerators to watch them burn alive, and in one case, he tied two cats together by their tails and threw them over a wire and watched as they clawed each other to death. When telling the story, Richard laughs as he recalls how much noise the cats made. Richard wasn't only receiving the abuse from home. He had a small gang of teenagers who would bully him in school and on the playground.
When I was a young man, I found out that if you hurt somebody, they'll leave you alone. Good guys do finish last. When I try to leave everybody alone, just do my own thing, everybody just wanted to hurt me. Until one day, I decided, well, I had enough of this picking. And I went upstairs and I took a bar, which the clothes used to hang on in the closet. And I went back downstairs, and there were like six young men, still figuring they were gonna mess with my head. And we went to war. To their surprise, I was no longer taking the beating. I was giving it. And that's when I learned it was better to give than to receive.
The thrill and release he felt from these attacks were now ingrained in Richard's psyche. He had a taste for power and control. He was earning a reputation as someone he didn't want to cross, and if you looked at him a certain way, even by just passing on the street, he would set his sights on you and wouldn't relent until you were either bleeding on the pavement or dead. Richard, now 18 years old, was in a bar when a man rubbed him the wrong way and he felt like he was being disrespected. So he would wait. A few hours later, he found his moment to strike.
I come out of this bar. I see him sleeping in his car. I said, I got you, little sucker. Now I got you. I'm gonna light your fire. And I did. I got myself a bottle, some gasoline, and I threw it in the car with him. And he was screaming and yelling and burning. And the car burned, and I could smell him. I walked down the block. I could hear him as I turned the corner. He was still yelling.
In 1960, 25-year-old Richard Kuklinski, married with two sons, met 18-year-old Barbara Pedrici at the warehouse where they both worked. Things escalated pretty quickly, and Barbara soon found herself being totally consumed by Richard, which is pretty common when new love begins to blossom. The difference in this instance is that Barbara realized how little time she was spending with her family and friends. She talked to Richard about this and thought it would be best if they take a step back and not see each other as much, to which he responded by stabbing Barbara in the back, saying, "This is an object lesson. Never leave me." They would go on to have two daughters and a son, and Richard would this time relish his role as a husband and father. It was evident from early on in their relationship that there were two sides of Richard Kuklinski, as Barbara would describe her marriage with him as being with good Richie and bad Richie. The good was a devoted husband and father, never drank, never did drugs, and was never unfaithful to his wife. He would provide for them with lavish gifts, vacations, sent his children to the best schools, and protect his family at all costs. He would say that he would kill an entire room full of people if it meant to save his. The bad was Barbara suffering broken ribs and a black eye, amongst many of the other injuries she would receive if she caught him in a bad moment, and there were more than enough times he would tear apart the house. The children were spared his wrath for the most part.
It was a Jekyll and Hyde existence. The way it was, and the way I wanted it to be, was absolutely two different lives. I wanted one life. I had to have another life.
With only an eighth grade education, Richard would find ways to make money outside of his warehouse job. After getting into a debt with Roy DeMeo, a capo in the Gambino crime family, DeMeo and his crew came to collect. The crew would attempt to beat Richard, who stood at 6 feet 5 inches tall and weighed over 300 pounds. But Richard held his ground and impressed DeMeo. Always looking to seize an opportunity, DeMeo could see that Richard would be more profitable to him alive, so he brought him in to be a part of his crew. Richard had to prove himself by carrying out a hit for DeMeo. They drove around for a while, and DeMeo pointed out a man walking his dog down the street. Richard got out of the car and walked towards the man. As they passed each other, Richard turned around, shot the man in the back of the head, and got in the car. With Richard now a member of DeMeo's Gemini crew, one of the most feared crews in the mafia world, his new career began to pick up fast. He was required to answer the call at a moment's notice, and his family knew not to question him when he would disappear for days at a time or get up and leave with no explanation, just to return a few hours later and act as if his abrupt departure was perfectly normal. One Christmas Eve, Richard was putting together some toys for his children when he received a phone call, put on his shoes, and walked out the door.
The man owed me money, and he was giving me the runaround. I told him I wasn't happy that he wasn't going to pay me. But he had that attitude that nobody could hurt him. I think he was wrong. Anyway, he never saw Christmas. I walked away, got in my car, and went home. I put toys together for the kids for Christmas. I saw the broadcast while putting the toys together that came down. Mob-related killing. That was the first time I knew I was mob-related.
Richard quickly became DeMeo's favorite enforcer for his lack of regard and empathy for the people he was assigned to murder, and he did so with ease. There was a hit that DeMeo wanted done, but nobody could get close enough to him, which played right into Richard's hands. He took pride in killing people others couldn't. Richard followed this man to a disco bar to stake him out and realized the place was always busy. Richard tried to figure out ways to get close to him without attracting attention to himself, but to no avail. This is until he noticed a gay couple dancing and realized that nobody was paying attention to them. In the 1970s, being gay was still kind of taboo, and most people would look the other way when they saw a gay couple. So one night, Richard showed up to the bar with the most flamboyant outfit he could find, and was dancing around the dance floor without a care in the world. He was right. Nobody was paying attention to him. So he danced his way towards the man, and when he was close enough, he pulled out a hypodermic needle and stuck him with it. Within seconds, the man died of a heart attack. At the turn of the decade, Richard befriended a man named Robert Prongay while they were both staking out a hit at a New Jersey motel. They quickly sized each other up and realized they were both contract killers. Prongay, a former demolition expert in the military, was known as Mr. Softy because he drove an ice cream truck and came off as an unassuming, polite man who was loved by all the kids in the neighborhood. But he lived a double life as well. He was a sadistic killer who Richard dubbed the craziest man I have ever met. He would take rides with Mr. Softy and would watch as he gave fresh ice cream to the little kids and cyanide-laced ice cream to their fathers. They grew very close, and Richard would learn a lot about killing with poison and how to use it in various ways. Prongay, with Richard by his side, drove up alongside a man and sprayed a mist from a spray bottle. The man was dead within minutes, and Richard would find that the use of cyanide was a great way to kill.
You could, put it in liquid form. For instance, a person could be in a bar. You bunk into them by mistake, or say that you're intoxicated, spill the drink on them, and leave. Everybody just looks around and thinks that you're drunk or that you just had an accident or something. Meanwhile, it's soaking through their clothes and into their pores and into their system. And eventually, they'll die.
Richard and Prongay would team up from time to time to commit murders, but generally, Richard liked to work alone, especially when the business involved his rackets. George Maliban was in the pornography business and wanted to score some illegal videos from Richard. Carrying $27,000, Maliban met with Richard to seal the deal, and when Maliban sensed that the deal was going awry, he became angry and threatened to kill Richard and his family. Maliban was found several days later in a 55-gallon drum.
The Serialholic will return after a quick break.
Hello, Fresh!
You know, Garrett, the victims of the Cheshire murders from episode 3 were spotted at a grocery store.
Sounds like a reason to stay at home and order HelloFresh.
Yes, it does. With HelloFresh, you get farm-fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your doorstep. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit.
Dave, let me tell you. The pork tacos. I don't know if you've had them yet. Oh, I've found a new love in life. They're so good. And let me tell you, I'm not the smartest guy in the room, all right? I'm not the brightest bowl in the bowl shop or whatever you want to say.
Don't sell yourself short.
Whatever you want to say it. But I'm telling you, it's super easy to make. Anybody can do it. Step-by-step directions. The box comes right to your door. What more can you say? It's HelloFresh, guys. Everybody knows that the America's number one meal kit, it's the easiest option to cook yourself some dinner.
So I actually introduced my son to HelloFresh, and he's 22 years old, and he still eats he's five. He eats chicken nuggets and tacos. So I actually made him the cheesy beef and black bean enchiladas. And let me tell you, he actually stepped out of his realm.
It's like he discovered the keys to the universe.
Right. He was like, okay, what have I been missing my entire life? So I'm going to try something new. I'm actually going to substitute, his usual chicken nuggets and make them the balsamic rosemary chicken.
That one was good.
Something fresh.
That one was good.
I had that one before and it was banging.
Listen, figuring out what's for dinner is not at the top of anyone's summer activity wish list. HelloFresh delivers mouthwatering, chef-crafted recipes and fresh ingredients to your door so you can spend your summer doing whatever you want.
Stuck in a recipe rut? Take a bite out of something new with 40 recipes to choose from weekly. With options to please even the pickiest of eaters, like my son, you'll always find meals everyone at the table will enjoy. To get all this, go to HelloFresh.com/CriminalAF16 and use code CriminalAF16 for 16 free meals plus free shipping.
And again, go to HelloFresh.com/CriminalAF16 and use code CriminalAF16 for 16 free meals plus free shipping.
And don't forget, tag your meal creation at #HelloFreshPicks.
America's number one meal kit.
Now back to the Serialholic.
It was during his relationship with Prongay that the idea of freezing a body would throw off the police when trying to determine a time of death. The man who would be a model for this experiment would be Louis Masquet, a man who made a business arrangement with Richard to purchase cases of pornographic videotapes. The deal, in which Masquet would pay $95,000 for the videotapes, was scheduled to go down at Richard's garage, but would never come to fruition, as this day would be the last time anyone saw Maske alive. His vehicle was found a short time later, and the storage compartment where Maske kept his money was gone. It is believed that Richard and Mr. Softy kept Maske's body in the freezer of the ice cream truck, and then was later transferred to Richard's walk-in freezer at his garage. It would be 2 years until Maske's body would be found in the same clothes that he went missing in. Police were baffled, as it appeared that Maske hadn't been dead very long. During the autopsy, however, ice crystals were discovered in Maske's tissue, and Richard would become a person of interest for his murder, as he was the last one to see him alive. This is how Richard became known as the Iceman. Through another racket, Richard was contacted by a man named Paul Hoffman, a pharmacist who was looking to score some drugs to sell in his pharmacy in order to make a huge profit. He brought with him $22,000.
He took the bag, threw it, opened it, showed me a whole mess of money. A whole mess of cash. He said, I got the money right here. And he came back and he says, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? How am I going to get this merchandise? I put the gun under his chin. And I said, there is no merchandise. And I shot him. He didn't die. The gun jammed. He was gurgling. I had hit him. Blood was pouring out of his mouth, and he was in what I would imagine to be a lot of pain. So there was a tie iron there. I took the tie iron and I hit him with it, which knocked him out. And he died. So then I took him and put him in a 50-gallon drum, put it on the side of a motel. It was behind Harry's Corner. I listened to the people. I went into Harry's every morning. The thing was there for a long time. I looked at it every day. It was there. I went to Harry's every day. One day, it was just missing. Continued to go into Harry's to see if anything was said about it. Nothing was said. I don't know what happened to that drum.
Paul Hoffman's body was never found. He and Prongay would maintain their relationship for some time until one day they had a falling out when Prongay threatened to poison a water supply and kill thousands. Mr. Softy was found hanging out of the driver's side of his ice cream truck with numerous gunshots to his head and chest, courtesy of Richard Kukliski. By 1982, the heat was on DeMeo and his Gemini crew. If you know anything about the Mafia, it's that they don't like being in the spotlight and something needed to be done. The leadership of the Gambino crime family wanted DeMeo out of the picture, but he was feared amongst his family. John Gotti and Sammy the Bull Gravano reportedly turned down the hit, as did many others. The people or person who had to do this were the ones who were closest to him. The task, according to Richard, was given to him. In January of 1983, a meeting was set up at the home of one of the Gemini crew, and DeMeo was not seen again until his body was discovered in his trunk riddled with bullets. After nearly 30 years of working for the Mafia, and with DeMeo now dead, Richard decided to go out on his own. He was making more money than ever before with his rackets, including gun smuggling, illegal pornographic movies, extortion, money laundering, and of course, murder for hire. By now, Richard has used numerous methods for murder. Gun, knife, poison, burning, strangulation, Molotov cocktail, and leaving people to be eaten alive by sewer rats, but he never stopped looking for new ways to kill. He once pulled over to the side of the road and asked the man for directions. When the man approached his window, Richard pulled out a crossbow and shot the man through the forehead. This was not a contract, not a personal vendetta, and not because he was owed money. This was a stranger who was merely in the wrong place at the wrong time, and Richard simply wanted to try out his crossbow. Richard's new venture on his own would prove to be his downfall, as he was growing careless and paranoid. His new business partner, Gary Smith, would help him run his rackets and would set up a meeting in which Richard would kill the person and steal their money. Richard, feeling the pressure from law enforcement, was growing concerned that Smith would flip. Richard set up a meeting with Smith in a motel room, and he laced his food with cyanide. Not dying fast enough, Richard strangled Smith and hid his body under the bed in the room. Several days later, Smith's body was found. The autopsy revealed that Smith died from asphyxiation. If he would have just let the poison do the work, Smith's death would have been listed as natural causes, but because he strangled him, it was now a homicide. The FBI assigned an undercover agent to act as a hitman who met with Richard at a highway rest stop to give him cyanide to kill a fictitious cocaine dealer. Richard was told that the man would be carrying $85,000 and it was all his once he committed the murder. 2 hours after this deal was made, Richard was arrested. The wrath of the Iceman was over. There is much debate on how to classify Richard Kuklinski. Was he a serial killer? A street thug? A contract killer? In my opinion, the answer is all three. It is not often where the line between these three is crossed. Serial killers are triggered by people who meet their specific preference or reminds them of someone who did them wrong in the past, such as a prostitute may trigger someone whose mother was also a prostitute and would abuse and abandon them as a child. A woman with blonde hair in her early 20s may trigger a person who was scorned by someone of a similar type. Serial killers are also typically consistent in their manner of killing, whether it be strangulation, stabbing, or shooting someone, to name a few. A contract killer is someone who is paid to murder a person, and it's more than likely that they have no emotional or psychological connection to their target. Many skeptics of him being a serial killer will point to the fact that he was a con man, a hustler who killed people for financial gain, which is true, but these instances occurred well after he began killing. If you take a deep look at his history, with the physical and emotional abuse he received from his parents, the death of his brother, the torture of animals as a youth, the torment he received from his peers, it's easy to see that Richard separated himself from emotion at an early age. In his case, his trigger was disrespect. If he felt you disrespected him or his family, you were dead, or at least beaten to near death. This all stems from his childhood when he had no control over those who were supposed to love and care for him and those who betrayed his trust. Once he gained control, anyone who made him feel as if he didn't paid the price. His story has all the makings of a serial killer. The contract killing, that was just a perk. People will continue to debate these theories, but one thing is consistent. Richard Kuklinski was a sociopath. His grandiose claims are the main reasons behind this debate. Richard would go on to say that none of the murders ever bothered him. But there was one murder that never happened that would eat at Kuklinski for the rest of his life. This one goes back decades, and if he had, his entire story would be different. He wished he would have killed his father.
This episode of The Serial Holic by Criminal AF was written and produced by me, Dave Jari. Executive producers for this episode are Christine Rivera, Beth Davis, and Dusty J. Hicks. Associate producers are Paul Hodge, Tara Mazur, Chantal Daggett, Jay Rawlings, Laura Shin, and Terry Burke Wolin. Producers are J.D., Trent Gobble, Devin Dean, Jan O'Donnell, Lisa Perello, Alicia Knight, Maria Celine, Chris Owen, Justin Ware, Emily White, and Beth Esselman. For an unfiltered, interactive version of this episode, hosted by Dave Jari and Garrett Quarter, follow Criminal AF, available wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to follow Criminal AF Pod on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Signing off from Studio Chloroform, keep your head on a swivel, and stay safe till next time.